Welcome to the Fair Parenting Podcast, where we cover people's stories, ideas, and the progress towards fair parenting.
Welcome to the podcast. Today is an episode in the replay series. We're revisiting my discussion with Dr. Larry Waldman, PhD. He served in the family court in the USA for over 20 years. And in this episode, he discusses his stories and experience of the family court and his insights. It's a really good episode, thanks to Dr. Larry. And so here we go, my episode with Dr. Larry Waldman, PhD. Welcome to the podcast. Today's guest is Dr. Larry Waldman, who is a psychologist, professor, speaker, and author. He is a forensic psychologist in Phoenix, Arizona, and has worked with children and parents in a solution-focused way. Dr. Waldman was a past president of the Maricopa Psychological Society. Also, he's been a director of psychological services for the Charter Psychiatric Hospital of Glendale, an official guide, in other words, top expert, on the subject of parenting for selfgrowth.com, and he was a medical consultant for the Social Security Office in Phoenix. He continues as an adjunct graduate professor in counseling and serves on the Professional Advisory Board of Stepping Stones of Hope, a charitable organization serving children who have lost a parent. Dr. Waldman was also co-chair of the Early Career Psychologist Committee at the Arizona Psychological Association for 5 years. He's certified by the American Council on Exercise as a fitness specialist and is a yoga instructor offering, I love this word, but I'm going to have trouble saying it, psycho-yogology. Wonderful term. He's had many articles published in the local and national press and has written 7 books. Dr. Waldman trained as a public speaker and presents for PESI. His signature presentations are The Business of Private Practice, The Graduate Course You Never Had, which is a great title, and The Teaching Parents to Parent. He's made over 150 presentations to attorneys, chiropractors, psychologists, family therapists, counselors, social workers, school psychologists, and school counselors. To the community, Dr. Waldman speaks on parenting, marriage, stress, depression, anxiety, wellness, grandparenting, and psychotherapy. Dr. Waldman, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you. My mother be proud. I'm glad to be here.
Thanks very much. I'm very glad you agreed to speak to us. Reading your list of expertise, it's so impressive. I wish we could have had you on my own personal case. I think they would have helped the court quite a lot, but sadly, that wasn't what happened. Just to go to your own work, you've written 7 books. As I said, the titles of some of them are great. I guess that's really important when you're writing a book. For example, Who's Raising Whom? Coping with Your Adolescent. The Graduate Course You Never Had, which I think is just fantastic as a title. And Too Busy Earning a Living to Make a Fortune. I think a lot of people will resonate with that. Can you tell us a bit about those?
Well, of course. Sure. Thank you. Those books have been done over 40 years or so. The first one was Who's Raising Whom? And that's a second edition. And that is basically teaching parents how to manage their children's behavior. You know, parents receive little or no training in how to raise this young human being. You know, you've heard this before, I'm sure, but you know, you need at least a driver's license, you know, to drive a vehicle. You can just become a parent.
Yes.
And like most parents, kind of plagued by the seat of your pants, if you will. So that book gives parents at least a kind of a system to follow in terms of dealing with their behavior and teaching the child to grow up to be responsible and resilient. Coping with Your Adolescent was the follow-up book to that. And as I like to say, if you didn't read the first one, you're sure as heck going to need the second one. dealing with the teen. You didn't mention the marriage book, but I'll mention it here. That one's entitled, How Come I Love Him But Can't Live With Him? By the way, I get a lot of my titles from patients during sessions. I had a parent once say several decades ago, you know, who's raising who here in this house? That's not grammatically correct, but certainly gets the point across. And I agreed, you know, that, yeah, the house was being run by the five-year-old. And also, I had a parent say, I guess I have to learn to cope with my teen. Well, that's largely true, because if you want to change their behavior, you know, just a year or less before they're going to leave the house, it's not going to go very well. I've had many wives, in fact, say, because typically women are more likely to seek psychotherapy than men, say, you know, how can I know I love him, but sometimes I sure as heck don't like him, or you know, maybe even love him. And frankly, I might have even heard that once or twice from my wife. Although we've been married 51 and a half years. So.
That's amazing.
I think it's going to last.
Yes. Yeah. And my favorite title from your books is The Graduate Course You Never Had. It's particularly intriguing. Can you give us a brief taste of what that's about? Because I'm probably going to get that afterwards.
Sure. Well, that book is designed for mental health providers who are interested in developing a thriving practice. Again, people just, you know, do things without a lot of training. You know, as I like to say, you know, if you just graduated from culinary school, are you ready to open a restaurant? If you just graduated from mechanics school, are you ready to open a body shop? And of course, the answer to all that is no. So just because you have a terminal degree, be it a master's degree or even a doctorate, you've not had any kind of coursework on how to conduct a business of providing psychotherapy. And like any business, whether you're selling widgets or offering psychotherapy, you're going to need patients or clients, and you're going to need to learn how to market to get those clients, not to mention the billing and the management of staff and all those other things that goes into running a small business. So that's what that book is about. And that's the second edition.
Okay. And your latest book is called Love Your Child More Than You Hate Your Ex. I think that's a title that's going to resonate with a lot of our listeners. Why, in your opinion, do you think some people don't do that?
Well, the data, at least here in the States, shows that about 20 to 25% of couples have seriously acrimonious divorces. They're angry. They don't want just a divorce. They want martyrdom. They want revenge. And so they're and unfortunately, this frustration and anger, you know, falls upon the children, because what greater trick do you have up your sleeve than to align the kids against you, for instance? It's very unfortunate. I got into the family law arena about 22 years ago. I've done upwards of 100 custody evaluations appointed by the court. I was also what is called here a parenting coordinator, where the judge appoints me to couples who are divorcing but are still angry. And so it becomes my job to essentially referee between these couples. I try to do more than that. I try to actually teach them how to communicate and so on, and get them to understand that all this fighting, particularly in front of the kids or involving the kids, is extremely harmful to those children. So that's what I have done as well. And that's what led to that book. So I talk about my experiences. I talk about what divorce looks like to the child, especially an angry one, and the things that parents can do to minimize the effects of divorce on the child. And unfortunately, the things that parents tend to do, sometimes not even maliciously, sometimes unknowingly, that, of course, really make the effect of divorce quite traumatic for kids.
Yeah. Do you find that most parents are receptive to training, or do you find that in some cases one parent maybe, or neither parent, and they just want to win and they don't care about, it's not maybe that they don't care about the child, but they just don't see that the effect that it's having on the child, and they just want to win at all costs?
Well, a little of each. I can't tell you that I was successful in every parenting coordinating case. That certainly isn't true. Maybe I had a 50% batting average and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Because I wielded actually authority there. You know, as the parenting coordinator, I had power to make modifications in the parenting plan, even in the custody plan. When I sent a copy to the judge, we would have to, of course, sign off on it. But if it never occurred to me, made a recommendation to the judge, the judge simply rubber stamped it. So they had to really listen to me. In many respects, I was kind of like a judge and therapist all at the same time. So they listened, not always tough. In fact, I'll just share one more story that I remember. I was working with this case, couple divorced. It wasn't nice. This is in Phoenix, Arizona. Dad took a job back in Chicago in a couple that hung from a couple of years before. And the custody plan, the visitation plan was that he would get the kids over the holiday season and 2.5 months during the summer, which mom did not care for and so on. But that's what the judge ordered. That's what the judge finally ordered and so on. The night before, the children, two children, a boy and a girl, like 8 and 10 approximately, were to leave for Chicago to spend the summer with a mom. The night before they're leaving, mom comes home with a puppy. And now the children, of course, don't want to leave. Their father calls me, angry, mad, hysterical. I call mom. Mom blows me off. I call the judge and so on. And the judge writes an order saying the mom will return the puppy. The children will be on the flight, or mother will be held in contempt of court, and had already assigned partial to the case. And then he added another paragraph where the children would go to Chicago and stay there.
If the puppy stayed, then that was going to be contempt, and the children would go to the shoot. Is that the case?
No, the judge had it. I mean, he had had it with this couple, particularly with this mom. This was not the first time she disobeyed a court order. And so he reversed the custody.
Wow.
Ordered mom to continue seeing me, and then left it to me to notify the judge when maybe a change in custody should be considered. But this can be very ugly, unfortunately. And it's hard on everybody, but it's especially hard on the kids, because they're helpless in this situation.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very ugly trick, buying a puppy on the timing of it. I mean, I don't think we need to explain what's wrong with it. I think that you saw it, the judge saw it, and it just was wrong what happened there. But yeah, I mean, it's the cases often have things like that, and the person misbehaving can turn around and say, well, it's just a puppy, what's wrong with giving it to these children? But it is just very wrong. Yes, that sounds like it had the right outcome. I mean, as you said, she's broken previous court orders. Speaking more from a British experience, my experience in the British courts is that, not just in my own case, but in others, is that court orders get broken all the time, and there seems to be very little consequence. So I don't know if it's different in America, but certainly that story you've just told me just sounds a lot more positive than would happen here, in my experience.
In my experience in Maricopa Court, particularly when there is a specialist like myself assigned to that case, then the judge is pretty responsive, because they're the ones who appointed me in the first place. And so if I write to them or speak to them and say, hey, I have a problem here, one of the parents is not like coming to the meetings. That was common. They wouldn't, and we would have a confirmed parenting coordinating session, and one wouldn't show, and so on. And so in cases like that, I have no recourse but to contact the judge. And then the judge, of course, has, a lot of power to do what he or she thinks needs to be done to fix the situation. But the bottom line, though, is that, you know, what the court's looking for, you know, are two parents who are willing to put the needs of the child ahead of their own. And so the best thing that a parent can do in a divorce case, particularly a contested divorce case, to show that you really care about the children and so on. And when the court sees that, that's, you know, where they're going to go. Now, it's not just a game, of course. It's something that we need to do all the time. I mean, let's face it. That's what a parent is. You know, a parent is somebody, you know, who has to give up a lot of their needs. You know, we give up our money. We give up our time. We give up our comfort to raise these kids and so on. And just because we decide to get divorced doesn't mean that the children should have to sacrifice all of that. It's not. They didn't cause it. It's not their fault. Although sometimes, frankly, many kids think it's their fault. And they've told me, I've heard that at least a couple dozen times from kids, you know, kids who are crying, thinking that some way, somehow they were bad. They did something wrong. If they only had done this instead of that or whatever. And then, of course, what happens is these children are placed in what we call these loyalty binds, where they're caught between each parent, and so on. And that really puts a significant amount of stress on these kids. They're damned if they do and damned if they don't.
Yes.
I could cite all kinds of examples, but that's what the book talks about, the number of things that parents. Now, sometimes, again, you know, like I said, parents don't do it maliciously, but, you know, a simple thing like maybe asking the child when he's over at dad's, you know, let me know if there's any new TVs or appliances or things like that. Simple things like that. Now, that may sound kind of innocent, but we know what's behind that and so on. But then the kid might think, well, that's okay, you know. But then the kid might even say to daddy during the visit, oh, daddy, I see you have a new TV. And daddy says, yes, you know, I like to watch the football games and so on. Of course, that's American football. Then the kid might say, well, mom, just wanted to know. Yeah, and all of a sudden, the father says, now wait a darn minute here. You keep doing what happens here, stays here. You play. And all of a sudden, the kid like freezes up. It's like, oh my God. You know, and so on. I can tell you hundreds of stories. I remember this one story in particular. This was a very bright, gifted child. Unfortunately, caught in a divorce between two doctors, no less. So there's a lot of money involved. Two high-priced bulldog attorneys, which, you know, attorneys foster some of that stuff. At any rate, so kids like 9 or so, whatever. And he went in one session, he tells me, and he said, you know, Dr. Wallman, I've been doing some reading. I said, oh, that's nice, Steve. He said, you know, I was reading about World War I. He said, do you know anything about the Maginot Line? And I said, well, I remember a little bit from history. He says, well, I feel like I'm living that. I said, what do you mean, Steve? He says, well, you know, when I go from mom's house to dad's house, I feel like I'm crossing the French line into the German line. And when I get to the Germans, I've been interrogated by the Germans and so on. But when I have to cross back, I get interrogated again by the French. You know, I thought, out of the mouth of babes and so on. But then a couple of weeks later, he tells me this experience. He comes back from a visit with dad, and he's living now with mom and now stepdad. Mom's remarried, which often happens, by the way, frequently. It happens very often. In fact, the data suggests a significant percentage of people are remarried within a year of their divorce, which is one of the reasons why second marriages fail even more so than do first, because you want to be cult. So anyhow, he comes, he returns, and mom says, so how was your visit? You know, making just conversation. And he said, oh, fine. He says, mom made scrambled eggs with cheese and so on. And then she took us to the park and so on. And then stepfather steps in, grabs the kid by the shirt and says, She's not your mom. She's your stepmom. And as telling me this story, tears are just pouring out of his eyes. And I said to him, I said, Stephen, so what did you make of what happened to you? And he looked at me and he says, Dr. Waldman, I have to watch every word I say.
Yes, yes.
Look at the pressure on a 9-year-old. I mean, you may or may not be familiar with the Wallerstein study.
No.
Okay, well, if you're going to be working in this field, you probably must. She conducted a 25-year longitudinal study stemming from the 80s till the early 2000s, where she followed up on about 100 kids throughout the U.S., primarily in the western part of the country, who had gone through divorce, and followed them up and so on, you know, and so had like followed them into early adulthood. So some of these kids, you know, started out, you know, in primary school, and some of these kids were already in high school when, you know, during the study, but she followed all of them. And the long, you know, the making the long story short is that by and large, these kids grow into adults with far more problems than adults who, and she had a control group that she followed, a much smaller one. But the control group had much fewer mental health problems, much fewer issues with the law, and et cetera, et cetera. So kids who have to grow, particularly if they're younger kids, you know, and the real sensitive age is like 5 to 12, 13. Before that, they're too young to know too much. After that, you know, there are teenagers and they can kind of insulate themselves. But that middle phase there, those 8-9 years of, you know, 5-6 to, you know, pre-adolescence, is a very tough time mentally for kids caught in a difficult divorce, an angry divorce. Unfortunately, only a quarter or so, at least here in the States, do that. But there's lots of them. You know, our divorce rate here is 50%, some states even higher. And I don't know if you know the divorce rate for second marriages.
No.
It's 65.
Wow.
2 to 3 events. So it's not uncommon nowadays for kids to now, you know, endure 2 divorces.
Yeah, that's horrendous.
It is. It really is. In fact, I read a study not too long ago, at least here in the States, that there are more children today in the States living with step-parents, single parents, or grandparents than there are kids living in nuclear families. So where's our society going?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Very good question. What's your views on shared parenting? Because I read a study a week or two ago that said that even when parents didn't get on, shared parenting, you know, around about 50-50, still was better for a child in most cases than, you know, to just see every other weekend or whenever, holidays or whatever. Is that your experience? I mean, obviously, the what you're relaying about, you know, very hostile cases is very difficult for children. But I mean, do you think shared parenting generally is better if it can be done, if the parents can do that?
I'm of the opinion that children should have as much contact with each parent as is possible. That's how it all started, and that's how it should be. Now, again, what this takes, of course, is for parents to put away their anger and so on for the sake of the child.
Mm.
And again, think about it, you know, that's what parents do. I mean, how many times, you know, when these little tykes are small, do we get up in the middle of the night, you know, and we come and now they've wet their bed or they've thrown up in it or worse, you know, and so on. And, you know, this is what parents do. And in this case, this is what they have to do. You know, they have to, you know, put aside their anger for the sake of the child, and let the child, you know, see the other parent, for approximately half the time. In the end, they're doing their child a real service.
Yes.
Now, having done this, I was in practice for the better part of 50 years. I've seen this full circle. I have seen children who were alienated against a parent grow up, and they come back into my office now as a young adult, and they're mad as hell. And guess who they're mad as hell at? Not the parent who they were alienated against, the parent who taught them to become alienated.
Really?
And here's the irony. Here's the irony. The parent who's doing the alienation thinks that they're one-upping the other parent, and they're getting even with them. So they now have the lion's share of the custody of the child. But then that child grows up, becomes a teen, and then a young adult, and one day, and it happens in most of the cases, one day, somewhere between 15 and 25 or so, the light's going to dawn on this kid that was not a kid anymore, this adult, and suddenly going to realize, wait a minute, I have lost out on contact with my other parent because this parent, took advantage of me and so on. And the irony is, while the alienating parent had the most of the custody through this kid's childhood, they've lost them for the rest of their life. No, don't get to see the grandkids and so on. I've seen those cases, many of them.
That's very interesting. The people that alienation happens to often for many, many years go through very dark times and can see no end to it or no resolution. But what you're saying there is that, often the child will figure it out and find the truth, and that can help reconnect the child and the targeted parent. I think that's a really hopeful message to people who are going through alienation.
It is. Believe me, I've been there. I can't tell you how many cases like that I have. Now, the problem that happens is the parent who gets alienated against gets bitter and actually kind of turns after a while against the kid, thinking, come on, you should know better than this. And really they don't, because what do children know? Their world is very small. And I've counseled dozens of these parents who have been alienated against, and I empathize with them. It's tough. But I constantly say, leave the door open. Leave the door open. Send a birthday gift. Send a card. Send an email. Just let them know that you're thinking about them, that you love them, that you care about them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Someday. Another in critical time when this happens, and I've been there too, when that kid has a kid.
Yes.
And all of a sudden realize, the love you have for a child, this must be the same love my dad has or had for me. Sometimes that's the turning point.
That's interesting. And how are the courts over there in dealing with alienation cases? I mean, what you're describing there is a case that it sounds like a child can be alienated and it can go on for years until there is a resolution when the child's older. And that happens a lot over here. Is that similar in America where the courts don't always get to grips with the alienation and it just ends up having to play out naturally?
Well, the answer, of course, is it depends. There are, some places, where the courts are so backlogged and so on, where, it's very difficult just to get your case seen, much less have somebody step in. So that partly depends. In Maricopa courts, now I've been retired from active practice now for several years, But, you know, those courts are busy, but, you know, the judges try to keep a handle on things. Now, having an expert attached to the case will facilitate things.
Yeah.
And now a lot of people say, oh, that's too expensive, you know, having an expert. Well, it's one of those pay me now or pay me later kind of thing, you know. So I believe, of course, that it makes good sense right from the get-go to, if the court doesn't appoint somebody, to ask the court to appoint somebody. And I think that could serve them well. There is one other notion here. In fact, I talk about it in the last chapter of the book that you referenced, You Love Your Child More Than Hate Your Ex, is that there is a growing movement of what is called collaborative divorce. It's just starting to grow. It's called the International Association of Collaborative Programs, IACP. But it's actually international. There are offices all over the world doing it, but primarily in the States. And this is where it's not divorce mediation. Some people confuse it with that. But this is where both couples come to one office. In that office, they're assigned an attorney that works in that same office. But also, they see a mental health person in that office who sees both of them and the kids. And there's also usually a forensic accountant included in this office as well to help work out the financial affairs. So the way this is done, you know, it's done pretty much in a cooperative, collaborative way. So each parent has their say. They have a representative, you know, who's working for their interests. But at the same time, these attorneys, of course, are also very interested in the needs of the children and what's best for the entire family. Because, look, you know, if you hire a bulldog attorney, and let's say you're successful and getting a ridiculous amount of child support, and now father is basically broke, what's the future going to hold? Yeah, it's not going to work. It really isn't. You know, sooner or later, he's likely to say, heck with it, you know, and so on. So the idea is to make it work as best as it can. And looking into a collaborative divorce group, in my view, is, I think, one alternative that more people ought to consider.
Yes, that seems like a good idea. I mean, how does that work with attorneys? Because I guess they don't want collaborative outcomes. We could do a whole episode on perhaps. You mentioned about bulldog attorneys earlier, and I do wonder about some of the solicitors and barristers I've seen in the family courts. Who don't perhaps seem to have the interests of the child and the parents, you know, at the front of their mind. And I do wonder how some of those people can operate and sleep at night. But perhaps that's for another podcast. But do they tend to go with that collaborative approach in your experience?
No, unfortunately, no. Like I said, it's a growing movement. Truth be told, I wrote this book we've been talking about, came out about a year and a half ago or so now, and I just discovered this collaborative movement in the process of doing the research on the book. And I'd been in the family law arena for over two decades. So, you know, I hadn't even heard about it yet. So it was just coming about. But yes, I mean, we have this problem and the adversarial legal approach, as far as I'm concerned, it seems to work, you know, for criminal cases, and maybe it works reasonably well, you know, for civil suits, you know, and so on. But I don't think at all that the adversarial approach is appropriate in family law. I mean, most states here in America have what is called a no-fault divorce. You know, so it's not like you have to prove one person and so on, like they did back 20, 30 years ago or so. But it still doesn't matter, because you still get an attorney, and this attorney is interested in one thing, and that's winning. Okay. Not what's best for the kid, you know, not what's best for the couple as a whole, you know, but just, you know, winning for their client. Like I just said, sometimes winning is losing, honestly, because if you've devastated your partner, you know, you still, like it or not, are going to have to deal with that partner for until this kid is 18 or more. And if you've got a toddler on your hands here, you know, you've got almost two decades to deal with this person. But if you've absolutely pummeled him or her, you know, and embarrassed him or her to the high hills, you know, and so on, and broke them financially and so on, what do you think is going to happen? What are these next 20 years going to look like, or 15, and so on?
Yes. I wonder if the people that do this, though, think that far ahead, or if they're just acting from rage or whatever.
Unfortunately, that's the case. You know, they're looking only at now.
Yeah.
I know some attorneys, I've worked with many, and some attorneys, you know, do take the long approach and do try to calm down their clients and talk about, you know, what I've, you know, just been discussing here, the, you know, the long view, you know, that you know, if you pound the, you know, your partner into the ground, you know, it doesn't end there. You know, they're going to remain angry and so on. They're going to look to get back, you know, and so forth. So that's just human nature. So if you can make this divorce as civil as possible, it's better for everybody, especially for the kids.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And your book, does it contain advice that parents can use in order for them to actually avoid court? Because obviously it's better if they can arrange things amicably. Is it something that parents could buy and actually read either before problems happened or when a problem's just starting to happen? Are there sort of exercises or advice in there that they can use before things get so heated and so aggressive that court is maybe the only option?
Yes. In fact, I was hoping we'd get to that. Absolutely. I don't necessarily advise, just trying to work it out on your own per se. You might try. It's nice that you could try it. You could try, but I think you ought to have it looked at by maybe a mutually appointed attorney just to check it out and so on, before it's submitted to the court, because you might miss some things and so on. But, you know, there are a number of things, of course, that you want to do as far as the kids are concerned. You know, first and foremost is absolutely pound home the point, you know, that this divorce in no way whatsoever had anything to do with them. Now, are there cases where children play a role? Yes. Data shows that if a child is seriously handicapped, the divorce rate goes up about 10-15%. You know, raising a handicapped kid is challenging and so on. But still, again, you're not going to blame the kid for this and so on. So you have to keep reminding the child, you know, that this was not their fault by any means and so on. And of course, you want to continue telling your child that the other parent is okay, is a good person. Okay. Yes, mommy and daddy had trouble, you know, living together. It wasn't your fault, but daddy's not a bad person. And mommy wants you to spend time with daddy, and so on and so forth, and things of that nature. You want to be careful about putting the child in those, what I call loyalty binds, you know, where you're asking the child to do something, you know, against the other parent, and so on, you know, like spying for them, for instance. Or use the child as a messenger. When you get the daddy's out, ask them where the support check is. It's already a week late.
Yeah.
I'm not making this up. You know, can you imagine telling a 10-year-old little girl that? I mean, she's going over to Dad's house now. And what do you think she's thinking about? That I want to play with Dad right now? What's in her mind? What's killing her? Her guts are in a turmoil. Why?
Daddy, my mommy wants the support chair.
Oh, what are you doing telling? And then she gets it from the other side. I mean, oh my God, what are we doing to these kids? No, we can't do that. Things like that and so on. Unfortunately, that goes on. Another thing that parents do sometimes, again, not maliciously, but is not healthy, is that, when you get divorced, you're lonely. You had a partner that you could share stuff with, and now you don't. But here you've got this, 8, 9, 10-year-old, child, and now you sit down and you start sharing personal stuff.
Right.
So all of a sudden, the roles start getting blurred, if you will. Okay. Now, you're my friend, So the parent is now saying, "Oh, I feel so lonely," and the child's listening to, "Okay, now go make your bed." Well, wait a minute. One minute I'm your partner, and your sounding board, and now I'm back to a child making my bed. Which is it?
Yes, it's very confusing for the child. Yep.
You don't want to confuse role, believe me.
I'm just assuming in all of these cases that, the collaborative approach and your book and working with a psychologist, that you need to have two parents who are both acting in good faith. If one of them's not interested or is going to undermine or sabotage things, am I right in saying that this just isn't ever going to work, or will it, some parents who start out acting in bad faith see sense and see the benefit is in collaborating for the sake of the child? Or does it just generally happen that if they're not acting in good faith at the beginning, both of them, it's not going to work?
Well, that's pretty much a certainty. In my marriage book and in this book, I use this term that relationships are reciprocal. And I try to live this myself, and that is, what you put out is what you're going to get. Even in the computer world, what do they say? Garbage out, garbage in, right? Or garbage in, garbage out again. Well, that's even true in human relations. Doesn't happen that often, but sometimes something happens and I get angry. I can feel that anger growing. And I feel like, I need to. And then, fortunately, maybe it's because of what I've done for all these years, this thing like goes bing in my head and goes, if you come across to your wife in this manner, guess what? What do you think you're going to get back? Okay. And so I, take a deep breath, and I rethink how I'm going to pose it. And then it goes much better. And again, this is true of marriage when you're together and when you're not, especially when you're not. If you're going to send out messages of hostility and so forth, you're not going to get rose petals back. You're just not. So, if you want a workable, congenial system with your ex-partner, okay, well, then it's going to take some work on your part to put out those messages that are going to cause, help that other person send reasonable messages back to you. That's really what it's about. And sometimes you might even have to go to your parents and tone them down a little bit, because they're, of course, going to support you. They want to chop that other person all up. Well, no. I've had cases where the kid goes to grandparents, and then the grandparents fill the kid's head with garbage about the other parent.
Yes.
And that's not okay. That's not okay. And speaking as a grandparent, this is important as well, because very few courts today consider grandparent rights. My wife and I, we have two sons. Both sons are well married, and so on, and they each have children. My oldest son has one. fact, we just came back from visiting for his 8th birthday, and my younger son has twins.
Congratulations. It's wonderful. Sorry to interrupt, but a lot of us are having problems with our first child or our second child, but to actually hear of somebody who's gone through this and has grandchildren, and it's all wonderful and it's normal, it's just great to hear. And sorry, I know it's just normal life, but just fantastic. It's fantastic to hear that other people are actually living that way, and it all works out, you know, so it's good to hear. Sorry.
You're right. And it is kind of a bit of a mind-blowing experience. Just being your own kid parenting. Now, mind you, I'm an expert in that arena. Okay. So I watch it. My wife looks at me sometimes and something will happen. And she looks at me. You know, again, we've been together 51 and a half years. Well, not together. Actually, we've been together 2 years before that. So that makes it almost 54 years. So she'll look at me and she can read me. She knows. I know, she knows, but do we say anything? No. My kids will on occasion come to me, you know, because I am an expert in this arena, but not often, you know, because to them, I'm just dad.
Yeah.
Or in my grandkids' eyes, I'm papa, you know, but it is interesting how that works. And so, but my point is, especially if you are a parent of the son, because as you know, in the majority of cases, most of the custody is given to the female. It's changing, or the mother. It's changing somewhat now, but that's still probably the majority of cases. And there have been instances that I know, because I've been involved in some of those cases, where the upset mother gets back at the, you know, at her ex by restricting the visitations to, you know, his parents.
Well, it's happening in my case, yeah.
I can tell you, the relationship I have with my grandkids, I mean, we read to them by Zoom or FaceTime, you know, several times a week and so on. We visit them, you know, because we're retired now, at least once every 2 months. We just saw our other older grandson for his 8th birthday. If I was cut off from contact with them, wow, I would be really upset.
Yeah. And it does happen to a lot of grandparents.
Unfortunately, yes, because they're not even considered by the courts.
No. Well, hopefully things are going in the right direction with the law and courts. I mean, in this country, many years ago, grandparents did get some rights, but, you know, it's still trying to enforce rights is a different matter. If one parent is decided to cut the grandparents out, it's very hard for them. You know, even if they go through court and get a court order, if that court order is not obeyed, really, what can they do? It's very difficult. Hopefully things are going in a better direction and we'll end up, you know. So, I mean, what we don't want is our children and our grandchildren to have the same problems that our generations have had, and hopefully things are evolving there with you know, things like your book and, you know, the courts and new laws and more enlightened judges, and also research into things like parental alienation. Hopefully things are going in a more positive direction.
Yes. And let me also add, so many times couples are divorcing and have never attempted marital therapy. I mean, that's step one. I mean, I probably counseled several hundred couples, and I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I had a 100% bad marriage. Of course not. You know, many times these couples, you know, there was too much water over the bridge. But I staked a third or more of them. So before you get to that point, if you're you know, struggling with your marriage, you know, don't go it alone. Get help. Even if your partner doesn't even want to come, that's okay. I've worked with a number of cases where, you know, I just started with the wife because, you know, a lot of husbands, oh, I'm not going to go see a psychologist.
Yes.
Gradually, we brought him in. Get help.
Yeah.
You know, get help. There's help out there. There's people who do this, and try to avoid becoming a statistic.
Yeah. And as you said earlier, it's cheaper to pay now than pay later. And so if you catch a problem early, it's better than ending up in four or five years of court.
And boom, bank can bankrupt you.
Well, it has bankrupted. Yeah, just about. My house is up for sale, and I won't go too much into my case, but it's absolutely destroyed me financially and emotionally and almost physically too. But anyway, I'm sure you've seen many cases like that.
I have, and I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, thanks. In your book, are there exercises for couples to try, or how is it structured? Is it in sort of talking in different points of view of the child and the parent, or are there exercises and role plays, or is it research-based, or a little bit of each?
Well, in my marriage book, I have a chapter entitled How to Argue Constructively. Also, on my website, which is topphoenixpsychologist.com, I have a number of articles that I've placed there that have to do with communication, you know, during marriage. And I think that's, you know, that's one of the key things. Look, there's no such thing as, you know, a perfect couple, you know, and a perfect marriage. There's always going to be some kind of conflict. And so what I believe that one of the most important things couples can learn, you know, is to how to resolve their conflict. How to settle their hash, that's an American term. How to do that? Unfortunately, you know, what I saw in the hundreds, probably thousands of hours of marital work that I did, you know, it is people would have the basically the same issue that they had when they walked down the aisle is festering now, you know, 10, 15 years later. It never gets resolved, and so on. You know, and so it just stays there. And ultimately, you get the feeling like nothing's ever going to change. It's always going to be this way and so on. And you start to withdraw. And when you emotionally disconnect, as we call it, then, that's the beginning of the end. When you don't really care anymore and so on, that is, your marriage is in trouble. So the idea is, I think one of the best things that couples can do is like join a couples group or get into couples treatment, couples counseling and so forth, you know, and learn how to communicate, how to resolve your differences. Because if you can do that, you can go away. You know, as I said, you know, a healthy couple is not one who has no problem, because there is no such thing. Believe me, my wife and I have our issues. I mean, given what we've been through, we started out as two youngs. You know, we were both 25 at the time, you know, that we got together. What did we know? And so on.
Yeah.
You know, and so we moved. We had kids. We had our jobs. There were job changes. You know, our parents died. You know, and so on. There's lots of things that now your kids grew up, kids got married, kids had kids. You know, there's so many changes that go on. There's always going to be plenty of opportunities for misunderstandings and conflict. Therefore, you have to learn how to communicate.
That's a great point. Yeah, yeah. Because as you said earlier, you know, you have to do a lot of training before you're allowed to drive, but you don't have any training for marriage or parenthood, and you're almost learning on the job. And it's probably not surprising that some of it ends up as a car crash. So I think that's really good what you said there about trying to learn how to communicate and argue.
Yeah, argue constructively.
Constructively, yes, yes. That's an important word to add. Can we talk about two of the phrases you use, edutainment and the other one I'm going to struggle to say, psychoyogology. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, edutainment, I'd like to think, has just occurred. I'm hoping that your audience, you know, hearing our discussion here, were both educated and hopefully a little entertained at the same time. So I just made that word up and put the two words together, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
The psychology is that I'm retired from active practice, so I no longer see patients and so on. But I continue to speak, write. I do some coaching of young therapists who are hoping to develop a thriving practice and so on.
Yeah.
So I do that. And of course, I do some writing as well. And at the same time, I started doing yoga about 12, 13 years ago now. I've always been into fitness, even as an early teen, but I never really looked at things like yoga and so on. But I was kind of pushed into it by a yoga instructor at a gym I used to attend. And she got me into it, and I immediately began to see the value of it. And so I started doing it, and then actually I started teaching it. So I teach it now at the condo that we live in here in Phoenix and to the residents. And I do the same thing. We also have a condo in Southern California where we go in the summer to get out of the Phoenix furnace there, and I teach to the residents there. And as I do that, it's more than just doing poses. I emphasize the meditative part,
mm-hmm.
and the breathing part, and the staying present part, and so on, that yoga encompasses. So actually, for me, as a psychologist, yoga really is a good fit. So again, I put those two words together. Say your knowledge, if you will.
You should make a website with that name, although it'd be a bit difficult for a lot of people to type in. It's a little bit of a spelling test as well, that word. We covered yoga and meditation a couple of episodes ago. We had a teacher come on the podcast, and it's something that I've used since my court case has been going on for over 4 years. And it's something that I've found has helped me cope. And I've met, 4 years, quite a long time, and I've moved during that time. And so I've had a couple of teachers I've worked with, and I found it helpful in dealing with the stress and also to gain some sort of perspective. And I think it can help parents in this area.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question, because obviously going through a contested divorce, according to studies on stress, is the second most stressful thing you can go through, next to going to jail.
Wow. I mean, I think I'd prefer jail, but I think everyone's different. But I think I would. If I knew I was going to see my child at the end of it, I think I would go for that. But sadly, they don't offer that in the English family court. Anyway, one question that's just occurred to me while we were talking in the last few minutes. When I was talking to psychiatrists and psychologists for my case, because we had to recommend, each party recommended a practitioner to the court. That's the way it works in England. They only appoint one, and it has to be agreed by the judge. Both parties put their choice forward. So when I was talking to practitioners, I found that quite a lot of them were dropping out of that area of the law, at that area of practice, because I was told it was because it was just so stressful. Is that something that you've found over there? I mean, you said you practiced in family law for over 20 years. Did you find it took a toll on you dealing with these cases?
No, again, because I learned to manage it. But yes, there's a lot of mental health providers that avoid this field, which at the time was basically good for me, because I had all the cases I needed. But yes, it can be stressful. Certainly, I mean, being cross-examined by someone who's trying to break down, what you said is not the most pleasant thing in the world, but it's just business. So some people handle that, better than others. Having people get angry at you because you wrote something they didn't like, again, isn't the most pleasant thing. But, as I used to say, I'm just following the evidence.
Yes.
Plus, there's always the possibility that someone might want to take some legal action against you. Although in the States, if you are appointed by the judge, then you are legally protected. You cannot sue. And so on. So almost all of my cases that I did, I was a court appointee.
Yeah. And regarding your book, where can people find it and where can they learn more about you in terms of web links and social media? And also, is your book available in audio form?
Who's Raising Whom and Coping with Your Adolescent are currently available in audio form. All my books, of course, are available on Amazon. You can look at them and my articles and so forth on my website, which is topphoenixpsychologist.com. I'm also available to do speaking. I've actually spoken in London several years ago to a group on stress management, but I do a lot of speaking on a lot of different areas. So if you're ever looking for a speaker, then certainly get me a call as well.
Okay, fantastic. And your website?
Phoenixpsychologist.com.
And are there links to your books on that page? If somebody went there, can they use it as sort of a jumping off point to Amazon?
Yeah, well, if you go there, then they send you direct to Amazon. Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll put the links in the show notes as well, so that so people can just click on them and get there and find the books and the information. So thanks very much for talking to us, Larry. It's been really interesting, so much insight, and I'm sure that there's going to be lots of content in this episode that are going to help parents going through problems and hopefully help to bring better outcomes for them and their children. And I hope people can find your book using the show notes and get lots of value from that.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Okay, take care. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. Please join us next time.